Great. All right. Well, let's get started. I'm going to put my anytime if you have any questions at all. Okay. Okay. The Rivadim method is first of all is nothing new. We call it today the Rivadim method in order to give it an identity. But the truth is, we have learned Gemara for many, many centuries. We have over 500 from the Rishonim and the early Achronim to document the way that they used to learn. And the reason that we have a need today for explaining the method and bringing it out in a formal fashion is because today we have more and more individuals who are learning Gemara and less people who know how to learn Gemara. And the reason for this sad phenomenon, that is that they don't know how to learn, it's a very happy phenomenon. The reason we have this is because the printed books that give people a misimpression about the way the text is supposed to be read. When you look at a typical page of a Vilna text, you see a basically a continuum of Talmud that goes from the top of the page to the bottom, and the average learner assumes that because it looks like a book and it it feels like a book, that therefore one should learn it as a book, meaning that one should take the book and read it from the first line and then the second line and then the third line from top to bottom, page after page. And the truth is that Talmud was not meant to be learned this way. Learning Talmud this way makes it virtually impossible to understand what's really going on the page, because the Talmud is really more of a mosaic of different texts that are different components, more correctly, that were superimposed one on top of the other, and in order to read them, one has to know how to sort them out, separate them, and read each one with the appropriate skills and methods, and then see what each component is adding to the other. I think that any learner of Talmud is aware that there are a certain of these components. For instance, we all know that on the Talmud page there's Mishnah, and that the Mishnah is not the same as the rest of the Gemara, that the Mishnah being put together by Rabbi Yehuda on the sea by the year 220 was there before the Gemara began to be put onto it as a commentary. And I think most learners are also aware that the Gemara contains Baraitot, which are of the same age and period as the Mishnah, though composed by other Tanaim, such as Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Oshaya and Bar Kapara and Levi, and that they are used by the Gemara as a tool with which to analyze the Mishnah. If, for instance, the Gemara disagrees with the Mishnah, it'll quote a Braita to challenge the understanding of the Mishnah. If it disagrees with an Amora, it'll challenge the Amora, because an Amora, because it's from the Tanaitic period. And therefore, we're all familiar with Mishnayot and with Braitot. And the prevailing opinion of people that are learning is that the rest of the Gemara, other than the Braitot, the Amoraim, the scholars who headed the Batei Medrash from the death of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in 220 until Rav Ashi and Ravina, who died, Rav Ashi in 425 and Ravina some 20 years later, and that the Gemara is a text that was written by them and is one unit. And this is not so. The Gemara, other than the Braitot, even when you separate out the Braitot, the Gemara is made up of two major components. There's the components of the Amoraim, which we call Memrot, which appear in the Gemara in very specific formats and in very specific language. And then, besides the Amoraim, there's a running commentary on the Amoraim, which the Rishonim called either Gemara or Talmudah or Stamed de Gemara or Stamed de Talmudah. And these two components, Amoraim and Gemara, together in various types of combinations over the 10,000 odd sugyot in the Bavli, and there are certain patterns about the way that they combine, and each pattern is to be learned differently. There are different rules about the different combinations of these components that if these they're not heeded, can lead a person down the path of thinking that they understand what the text is saying, when in reality they do not. And so far, and then I'll continue. Any questions?
Sorry, I'm just wondering if we were supposed to be, we have a packet or something that we're supposed to have received?
There will definitely be a packet of materials for the coming week when we learn Hamafkid. This meeting was intended to be like an introductory meeting to go over the high points of the method in advance of the learning of Hamafkid.
Thank you.
But you can look at any page of Gemara, and you'll see immediately that within the Gemara there are components that are named, such as Amar Rav, Amar Abaye, Rava Amar, and there are components that are completely anonymous. You'll also note that the components that are named are usually about 85% of the time in Hebrew, whereas the Stam of the Gemara, the running commentary which is anonymous, is in Aramaic. And many learners are unaware of the significance of this difference. Have you ever noticed these differences? So, are you there?
Sorry, my screen froze there for a moment. Did you ask a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Have you ever noticed that in the Gemara that the sentences can be divided into Hebrew components and Aramaic components, named components?
Yes, I learned that as just being that the brachos were in Hebrew most of the time.
That's certainly correct that the brachos are in Hebrew like the Mishnah, but have you ever noticed that the words of the Amoraim are also in Hebrew?
Not until you mention it. I suppose those from Israel, it would make sense that they would be.
Well, actually, in the Bavli, the Amoraim that are from Bavel, 85% of the time. I'm not talking here about the Yerushalmi, the rules there are different, but in the Bavli, both Israeli Amoraim and Babylonian Amoraim are brought in the Gemara in Hebrew. That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, I did not know that.
Now, the reason for that is because the Memra is not what the Amora actually said, because in Babel, the Amoraim spoke in Aramaic, of course. That was their everyday language, as English is ours. But when the Amora gave a shir, then his students who were there would take the conclusion of the shiur and formulate it into a short Hebrew sentence, attach the name of the Amora, and then they would learn it by heart the way they learned Mishnayot and Brachot by heart. And this is called a Memra. And therefore, the vast majority of times, the Memras of the Amoraim in the Gemara are in Hebrew. And this is by design, it's not by accident. And it's to clue us as to the function of the statement. There are certain statements of Amoraim that are in Aramaic. There are three different kinds, but they only account for approximately 12 to 15% of all of the Memrot in Shas, and there are very, very specific types, such as stories, conversations, things such as that. But halakhic statements are always in Hebrew. Now, when you notice that, and you take a look at the placement of these Hebrew Memrot on the page of the Gemara, you'll note that everything surrounding these Hebrew Memrot is in Aramaic. The introductory statements that present the Memrot are in Aramaic. The comments on the Memrot, the interpretation of the Memrot is in Aramaic. And all of these Aramaic sections are all completely anonymous. Have you ever noticed that?
presented to me as just the Stama of the Gemara being either Savarayim or things like that, Rav Ashi.
Well, indeed, the Stama, that we do call it the Stama of the Gemara, but it's not known whether it was Rav Ashi or someone else, because there were two generations of Amoraim that follow Rav Ashi who are mentioned by name in the Gemara, and it's hard to understand how Rav Ashi could have edited their memras when they lived some 70 years after he died. And therefore, there is another approach that's taken by Rav Shvira Gaon, who was fairly close to the US, and he said that it wasn't Rav Ashi and Ravina who edited, but rather Rav Asi and Ravina Baravuna, who lived died some 80 years later. And that would explain how all eight generations of Amoraim are mentioned by name in the Gemara. But this is neither here nor there, because whoever it was that edited it, the fact is that the formulation of the Gemara is very exact and very methodological. The rules that are used for putting a sugya together are consistent straight across Shas. Now, the reason why this is so important to notice the differences in the Gemara between the Hebrew Memrot, the Hebrew anonymous Stama de Gemara, is because the methods that were used by the scholars in each of these layers were different. And the way we're supposed to learn the Amoraim is different than the way that we're supposed to be learning the Stama de Gemara. And how depends on the type of sugya in which we find them. Has anyone ever explained to you that there are different types of sugyot in the Gemara?
No, I don't think I know what you mean.
Okay, I'll try to describe the basic phenomena, and I think that as you utilize these methods, when you look at any page of Gemara, you'll be amazed at what you see. Nine sugyas, Shas Bavli. The first kind of sugya was the Amoraic sugya, because it developed during the time of the Amoraim, which is from the year 220 till the year 500, eight generations in Bavel. And the way these sugyas developed, imagine yourself in a Beit Midrash of Rav in the first generation in Surah. There, what would you learn? What would you have to learn? You'd have Mishnah, you'd have Braitot, and that's it, because there wasn't anything else composed and formulated as of yet. And Rav would learn the Mishnah and the Braitot, and then on top of that, he would suggest his understanding of the Mishnah or Braitot, formulated into a Memra. Okay, now, the next generation, when you're in the Beit Midrash of Rav Huna, what do you learn then? So you have the same Mishnah, and you have the Braita, and you have the statements of Rav, which the Rosh Hashiva would add his comment, and now you have a sugya that's slowly growing, accumulating generation by generation, with the statements of the Amoraim basically accumulating one on top of the other in generational order. Is that understood?
Could you just say the name of what you were calling this first type in the Beit Midrash of Rav again?
Yeah, it's what Rav, in the Beit Midrash of Rav, which was in Surah, a southern Babylonian Mesopotamian city, they learned Mishnayot and they learned Braitot, and the comments of Rav on the Mishnah and the Braita, which are called Memras, the Memras of Rav, the statements of Rav. And then after these are formulated into Hebrew, then in the next generation, the students learn under Rav's pupil, who is Rav Huna. And so Rav Huna, what would he teach in his yeshiva? He would teach the statements of Rav on top of the Mishnah and the Braita, and then he would add his own statements. So now we have a sugya that has a mission two layers of Amoraic teaching. Is that clear? Is anybody there? Was that clear up to there?
That's very clear, thank you. Occasionally the screen just freezes and I can't hear the end of you, so that's why I wasn't responding right away. Thank you, that is clear.
Great.
Robert, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Do you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Let me go back to what I... Okay. So let me go back to what I said, that the generation, for a series of statements of Amoraim that are actually in chronological sequence. Now, on top of those Maimris, then the Gemara, whoever the Gemara is, we'll discuss that in a few minutes, comes and explains these Maimrot and presents them and describes them and interprets them, etc. So basically what we end up with is a piece of Gemara that is a collection of Maimrot that are in generational order with the sum of the Gemara on top of them. Okay, is up till now, is that fairly clear?
That's clear, thank you.
Well, I assume that my friend, you know, going back in Riverdale.
No.
And Rachel, I think they just joined in the last couple of minutes. So if you got any questions, Brother Hayman's still going over the Rosh Hashanah of the method, please ask if you follow what he says, okay?
Okay,
so, is there some material I should be...
Is there some material
I should be looking at? I don't think I got anything by email.
Well... all the materials are going to be for next week. This is, I think you know, it's just meant
to
sort of
explain
intro to class for those who don't have any clue what the difference is. So Robert Hayman is going to be talking all the stuff.
For the seminar when I was in Toronto, and I think that he could share that with you. Jay, do you have that booklet that you could share with them?
Okay. I think what you're going to have to do is you'll email me what you have, because I don't have the booklet in any form to get it on the website or email it to people. So if we get it in an electronic form, we'll send it out to the entire group.
Or we can make a
web
page of it.
Yeah, I don't know how to make a web page out of it.
All right, no problem. I'll send it to you. But let me go on with the explanation in the meantime so we can at least get that done, and we'll go from there. So that's good. All right, now, let's move on. So this is the first type of sugya that we have, is that it's called an Amoraic sugya. So its skeletal structure are statements of the Amoraic chronological sequence with the stomach of Gemara superimposed on it as a commentary. And the importance of separating these layers, because if the Stamed Gemara appears before, during, and after these Mimrot, later commentary, be that these later pieces that are superimposed on the Sugya, even at the very beginning of the Sugya, assuming that you've all understood all the statements of the Amoraim that appear throughout the Sugya, which of course you haven't if you're learning linearly. So the way that such a sugya is supposed to be learned is that you're supposed to read the Maimrot first and see what they're saying. The beginning of the sugya, the way you would learn Rashi on Chumash. And this is to be distinguished from the way that most of us learn, which is to learn linearly from the top of the page to the bottom without distinguishing the different layers. Are there any questions on this?
I'm sorry, Rabbi, could you go over one more time what you said about where the Memra is in regard to the rest of the Sugya? I didn't quite catch that.
As we We have a number of memras, or statements of Amoraim, spread throughout the sugya that are in chronological sequence because they accumulated one on top of the other from generation to generation. And then, after all the memras have finished accumulating, we have on top of all of them together an explanation and a commentary called the Stamma de Gemara, which is an anonymous and an Aramaic. And it kind of wraps itself, as envelopes all of the memras that were said, and explains them according to its own approach. So you could have, in a sugya could open with a couple statements of the Stamma de Gemara, then the first memra will appear as if that memra is responding to the Stamma de Gemara that's before it, but it is not responding to the Stamma. It actually was there before the Stamma, and the Stamma is building itself on top of the memra. Do you see what I mean? Did everyone hear that? Are there any questions?
So,
do you understand what I mean?
It's not a question of which comes first in the text. It's just a question of which came first historically, is what you're saying.
That is exactly right. And the order of the presentation in the text is not the historical sequence. It may be, but it usually is not. And therefore, if you don't know the historical sequence of the components, then the logical context of those components, one toward the other, is lost, obviously.
Thank you.
So now, that's the first type of sugya in Shas. That's called an Amoraic sugya, where the Amoraim are the basis of the sugya, and the Stamma, 60% of all of the sugyas in the Shas. But the other 40% are a very different kind of sugya. And that's a sugya that has origin not in the words of the Amoraim, but rather in the words of the Stamma de Gemara itself. It's a later sugya that developed, say, around the year 500, maybe a little bit later. And it's like an essay or an address made in konens from the Amoraim, but those components are like quotations that the Stamma de Gemara is bringing, and they don't necessarily form any continuum in and among themselves. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Sorry, the sound was quite bad there. If you could repeat that, that'd be helpful.
No problem. So the second kind of sugya that we have in the Gemara is structured in exactly the opposite way of the first kind. It's a late sugya that maybe develops about the year 500 or 520. It's like a speech or an essay or a lesson that quotes statements of earlier authorities for its own thought process. But the quotations do not form a skeletal structure of any kind on their own. Do you understand what I mean? Are we having transmission problems?
I hear you fine. I can hear you totally fine. I'm going to have some favors look into it.
Okay, so does everyone understand what I've said so far about distinguishing the two kinds of sugyas, one from the other? Okay. Now, great. Now, these two sugyot as you can understand from what I've described so far, are really mirror images of each other. One of them is a base of Amoraim with Stama on top of it, and the other one is Stama with Amoraim inserted into it. Now, this obviously creates a confusing situation. When you open up a Masechet of Gemara and you look at it, how can you know what kind of sugya you're looking at? Of the two different sugyot is different. It's opposite. Because in the Amoraic sugya, you need to learn the Amoraim first and the Stama second as a commentary on it. And in the Stama sugya, you have to learn the Stama first and the Amoraim as quotations within it. So if you don't know the difference between an Amoraic sugya and a Stama sugya, you are up the proverbial creek without a paddle.
Well, if you can hear me, what Rabbi Haman said is we need a method to figure out what type of sugya. Are we dealing with an Amoraitic like sugya or a Stama sugya? So now we're going to go into the methodology of how we can very easily figure out what type of a sugya is, the clear rules.
And I want to stress here that this is not what some people think is academic Talmudic. This has nothing whatsoever to do. This is the way the Rishonim learned. The Rishonim were completely aware of how this worked. For them, it was Aleph Bet. And the problem is not with sugyas, the problem is with us. Now, what we need to do is develop tools that enable any learner at a glance to be able to see what kind of sugya we're talking about, and therefore know what tools to use, what cognitive tools to use to learn the sugya properly according to its particular type. That is the goal of the Rivadim method. The Rivadim method, Rivadim means layers, because it separates the Talmud text into its component layers and then learns every layer according to its unique characteristics and methods. Up to this point, is everything clear? Great. Okay. So, now that you all understand the basic theory behind this, Dov is having a problem. Just a second here. Thank you. The reason why I'm writing instead of talking is that some of our participants don't hear me. Shall we go on orally or in writing? Rabbi Kelman, your decision.
Orally. If people really, really can't hear, it's a real problem, so we'll get them to read material. But once we're up and running, just talk slowly and continually. And if people really can't follow, okay, we'll have to stop. But I go ahead early.
Excuse me, I hope I'm not interrupting. Rabbi Kelman, I can hear you perfectly.
Okay.
I cannot hear Rabbi Hyman
at
all. I'm only getting choppy, fuzzy radio sounds. I can't hear anything.
Okay. So this might be some glitch with Israel. We once had a problem like this. It's very unusual. Usually the sound is really, quite amazing. And we have done already many programs and tested them many times. Our technical support guy, he's going to talk to the people in charge. So what I recommend is if Rabbi Hyman, you talk for a minute or two. If you guys can't hear anyway, the class is supposed to end soon. So if you really can't hear, I apologize, and we'll try to get you a proper recording of this if you can listen to any of the public stuff, and we'll work on it so for next week there won't be any problems. So we'll do the best we can. So that's all I can recommend. If you really can't hear, just like sign off, and we'll see you next week.
In any event, our time is almost up, the points I wanted to make, I think I made. If you read the information on the website, ready to understand. And next week, when we learn Hamafkid, then your conversation based on these points. I'm going to send Rabbi Kelman the material for next week's session. And he'll be able to distribute it to all of you by email in time. And in the meantime, if any of you have any questions after reading the website, please don't hesitate to write me an email at the email address that I'm going to type in right now. Please, are there any questions? Please ask them now. Mm-hmm.